Well, I want to thank the organizers for this wonderful opportunity to speak to physics audience, which I didn't do for maybe close to 17 years. So I also wasn't quite sure what I'm supposed to talk about, because I worked on rather different subjects in the last years. But then it was very exciting to read all these developments in string theory and supersymmetric gauge theory, where old techniques of Betanzatz started to play such an important role. And so I thought I would... And when I read these papers, I saw the kind of frequent use of the term integrability. And it was interesting, and I thought maybe this talk should be some kind of very general presentation, and there will be no results that are younger than 20 years, maybe 22 years. So this will be an overview. So the... the basic strategy will be the following. I will start with a brief reminder of what is integrability as we usually understand it in classical mechanics. After this, I will remind what is the Lux pair. I will remind what was the main idea of so-called quantum inverse scattering method, where essentially instead of quantizing integrable system, you quantize Lux pair. And that gives you a quantization of an integrable system as a quantization, as an integrable quantization of an integrable classical system. And then one can speculate a lot about different meanings of integrability. One of the meanings is factorized scattering. That is, of course, related to the old-fashioned classical notion of integrability, but you have to put lot more ingredients like locality, quantum field theory, and so on. So, okay, so let me just start from the very beginning, and then we'll see where we'll end. So, everybody knows what the integrability in classical mechanics is. If you have a phase space with n canonical momenta, n canonical coordinates, we have the classical algebra of observables, which is a Poisson algebra with this Poisson bracket, and a Hamiltonian, which is a function, an element of the algebra of observables, generates a Hamiltonian mechanics, a vector field on this manifold, and flow lines of these vector fields, classical trajectories, they are given by solutions to classical equations of motions. And then there is a very precise notion of integrability in classical mechanics. A system is integrable if there exists n on n-dimensional phase space independent functions. Independent means that if you take the differentials of these functions, wedge them, they are not identically zero. Or roughly speaking, none of them can be expressed as function of the others. They should commute with respect to the Poisson bracket, and they should commute with the Hamiltonian. Then the Hamiltonian is more or less the function of... Then the Hamiltonian is not dependent from these functions. It's more or less the function of the integrals, or, again, more precisely, this differential is identically zero. So this is the well-defined notion of classical integrability. And then... why this is important? Well, it's important to solve classical equations of motions. So there's this theorem, Liouville theorem, which came more than 100 years old, which essentially says the following, that if you fix level surfaces of the integrals, then each of these level surfaces is a smooth manifold, and it has a fine coordinate system. It means that it can be covered by charts which are related one to the other by the transformations, which are rotations and translations. And then in this affine coordinate system, the these equations of motions for the Hamiltonian, which is like this, are simply straight lines with the frequencies omega I, and these are the initial conditions. So then, at least locally, and there is a precise statement about it, which I don't want to go into, it looks like this. We have the, we can choose these integrals as one system of coordinates. We can choose this affine coordinate system at the neighborhoods of, at these level curves as the other coordinate system. And then I's and phi's together, they will be action angle variables for this integrable system. And it, again, one can choose these variables in such a way that they will satisfy canonical Poisson brackets. And this coordinate system is just, it's a very special Darboux coordinate system. So this is why integrable systems are so remarkable, that our equations of motions are linear in these coordinates. So now, in the usual Hamiltonian mechanics, the fundamental ingredient is the phase space and the Hamiltonian. Now, once you have an integrable system, the fundamental ingredients are phase space and collection of integrals. You can choose any function of these integrals, the trajectory still will be linear with different frequencies, but it doesn't matter. So, typical questions about integrable systems. Well, kind of simple question is, what is the classical spectrum? Basically, the values of the Hamiltonian. And then the more difficult question is, how actually to solve this system? In other words, how to find the transformation from one coordinates to the other? Well, this theorem says that it exists, but if you actually want to solve, you want to construct it. And then we have to go to the next ingredient of the theory, which came around relatively recently. It was the discovery of Peter Lex, which he did for certain infinite dimensional Hamiltonian systems known as KdV equations, Kertész-Weigl de Vries equations. That's so-called Lex pair. So this is a pair of linear operators. More precisely, these are functions on the phase space with the kind of matrix valued functions on the phase space, where V is some auxiliary space, and they should satisfy this condition that the equations of motions hold if and only if the time derivative of L is equal to the commutator of L and M. Well, let's look, let's see. If we just have this, what does it give to us? Well, from this equation, it's clear that you take any spectral function of L, in other words, any function which is invariant with respect to conjugations of L by a matrix, and this will be an integral of motion. Time derivative of such things, I mean, you can choose, for example, coefficients of the characteristic polynomial, traces of L, anything. Time derivative of each of these functions will be zero, so this will be integrals. The question is whether there will be commuting integrals. So that's completely not obvious from here. And this requires more structure. So if you really want to see how the Hamiltonian structure interacts with the Lex structure, we have to know what are Poisson brackets of the Lex operator. Now, I didn't say why this Lex presentation is so important. Again, it's a long story, but roughly speaking, solving the spectral problem for this L operator, or in the finite dimensional cases, just diagonalizing it, under some extra conditions, basically solves you the equations of motions if you know how to diagonalize this operator and if you know a little bit more. So this is sort of a scheme, this is the rudimentary outline of a scheme that gives you solutions, that answers you to the question how to solve. Now we want to understand how this conceptual notion of integrability is interacting with this rather remarkable technique of how to solve partial differential equations, certain partial differential equations. And this was the discovery of Skrjanin, who noticed that if we assume that this Lux operator satisfies this Poisson brackets, here L, T, tensor L comma Poisson brackets simply means the matrix acting in the tensor product of these two spaces with matrix elements Lij bracket LKL. This is exactly what we want to know. And so, if you assume this Poisson bracket, then the Jacobi identity is guaranteed by the so-called classical Young-Baxter equation. So, this equation implies that this Poisson bracket is well-defined. One should say a little more here, but again, this is not a lecture on classical integrability. I want to move as far as possible during these 40 minutes. So this is more or less the idea that classical Young-Baxter equation gives you a collection of Poisson structures on Lux operators. And the remarkable thing about these Poisson structures is that spectral functions, spectral invariants, now commute with respect to this Poisson structure. It's a very easy exercise that anybody can do. I will not explain how to do it. So, this is the essence of the so-called R-matrix method in classical mechanics, classical integrable systems. And I mentioned classical Young-Baxter equation. The name Young and Baxter, they came here historically. Actually, what Sklianin did is he learned about papers of Baxter in statistical mechanics. He learned about Young-Baxter equation. And then it was a very productive sort of cross-semination of ideas. And then he realized that if you will just take first derivative of the Baxter R matrix with respect to the coupling constant, it will satisfy this equation, and then the whole thing came out. So it was really the result of the fact that he knew about both Baxter's work on statistical mechanics and to this problem in classical mechanics. So then the result is the method of constructing and solving integrable systems. So roughly speaking, it consists of these steps. First, you have to find a solution to this equation. Then you have to consider these Poisson brackets. Not you have to, you can, if you want to construct these things. So then you have to fix, using some kind of physical principles, a Hamiltonian, which is one of the spectral functions for this Lux operator. Then, from what I already explained, you know that the equations of motions can be solved by some technique, which is known as the factorization method, and you know that this is an integrable system. And so this is, you know, these are four steps, but of course there is enormous information in each of these steps, and let me just mention some keywords here. First of all, this matrix L with these Poisson brackets really should be considered as follows. Let's assume that L is invertible. And then we can think of L as an element of some subgroup of a general linear group of this vector space. So this brings, this Poisson bracket gives you a Poisson structure on a Lie group. And if you have such Poisson structure on the Lie group, it's compatible in a certain way with the multiplication in the group. And this is so-called Poisson-Lie group. If you really want to use a Poisson-Lie structure on the group to construct an integrable system, one should require some more conditions, in particular this factorizability, that if you will take R plus R, where the factors in the tensor product are switched, this should be an invariant tensor in the Lie algebra. It should be invariant with respect to the conjugations. So there is a lot to say here. I don't want to go into this. Now, what's important is that these structures can be classified. You know, this is what basically mathematicians do. Say, physicists, they solve specific problems. And, you know, these problems can be fundamental, applied, but still it's a problem, a specific problem. So mathematicians usually do the following. Say, when they see some structure, they want to investigate this structure. Specific problem is less relevant. So this is sort of the result of the kind of development in along the lines of mathematical mentality. So you know quite a lot about Lie algebras. What do we know about Lie algebras? We know the classification of Lie algebras. We know the classification of simple Lie algebras. We know the classification of infinite dimensional semi-simple Lie algebras, some of them. So it turns out that these structures also can be classified. And this is the works by Belavin and Drinfeld. And if you ask what can be done for Lie super algebras, it turns out that similar thing can be done, but unfortunately, there are only partial results. So the recent results were obtained by Gizem Karali. She has several papers on this. Okay, so this is a big theory. One can read about it. There is a book by Raymond and Semyonov-Tyshynsky. There are reviews by Semyonov-Tyshynsky. There are many reviews but about the specific Hamiltonian aspects. There is a very nice book also, kind of, which is easier to read for physicists, by Babylon, Talon, and Bernard. So this is a well-developed field. So here's one simple example. Let's take as our vector space where we want to have our Lax operator, a two-dimensional vector space marked by complex number C. So that means we don't just have a vector space, but we have a vector space with a parameter. It's called spectral parameter. So here is the R matrix which satisfies the classical Young-Baxter equation with the parameter. Simply, you can forget about these lambdas if you remember that to each index 1, 2, this number is attached. It satisfies this factorizability condition in the sense that if you will be really careful about it, if you will say that lambdas are real, you will use this well-known identity, then this is the invariant tensor. The Poisson brackets will be like this. And it's very easy to see that these Poisson brackets are satisfied for the finite dimensional submanifold of all possible functions of lambda, which has this form. If you will just take the matrix, which is lambda times the identity, plus the 2x2 matrix with zero trace, which can also be always be written like this, with these Poisson brackets for the coefficients in terms in front of sigma matrices, then this ingredient will satisfy this bracket. And that's so-called classical L operator for classical spin chain. For classical SO3 spin chain. Now, you can do a little more with this. You can consider instead of the phase space, which is, well, more or less a sphere, because you can fix the length of this vector S. The length of the vector S is the Casimir function. Poisson bracket of this function with any of S's is zero. So you can fix it. So if you fix it, your phase space here will be two-dimensional. It's just a sphere. So, but this is not enough. This is not very interesting when you have two-dimensional phase space. Any two-dimensional system is integrable. That's what usually we learn in the textbook in classical mechanics. So let's take S2 to the n, where n is in any number. And now the phase space is this one. It's 2n dimensional. Natural coordinates on this space are SAn. Again, S squared for each n is fixed by its own Casimir function. And the Poisson brackets are between coordinate functions like this. So essentially, our Poisson manifold is the product of Poisson manifolds. So now, since this is an elementary a survey of 20, 30 years old papers, consider this as some kind of lecture. So feel free to ask questions during the presentation. Don't wait till the very end. Okay, so this is the phase space. These are coordinate functions. Now, let's consider these operators and let's multiply them along the line like this. What it means is that effectively it means that our Lux operator is block matrix with these entries, and this is sort of the, well, let's just consider this as an axiom. So again, the goal is to construct integrals of motions. So let's consider this product. Let's consider it trace. It's trace. Then again, it's a very simple exercise that these Poisson brackets for L, together with the fact that matrix elements of Ln and Lm commute with respect to the Poisson bracket for n different from m. So this fact implies that these traces commute for different values of lambda and mu. If you will take this function, the highest coefficient will always be 2 because this is the identity matrix. So you have n minus 1 integral, n coefficients, and the dimension of this phase space is 2n. So any function of the coefficients of this polynomial is a Hamiltonian of an integrable system. So integrals are t0, t1, tn minus 1. Take any function, it will be an integrable system. It's an interesting question what to do with this integrable system, how to solve equations of motions. I don't want to talk about this. Because at the quantum level, this will be the question about correlation functions. And as I understand, it's not time yet to discuss correlation functions, which would be structural constants of the fusion algebra in this QCD string theory business. So far, the discussion is about the spectrum. Okay, so now two more words. I kept saying that we take S squared to be 1, but in fact, we don't have to assume that this S squared is in the Euclidean matrix. So it can be either SU2 or SL2R, depending on whether it's Euclidean or Minkowski metric in R3. Whether you take really S1 squared plus S2 squared plus S3 squared or S1 squared plus S2 squared minus S3 squared. These are two different real forms of SL2C. As you noticed, everything was algebraical. So if you really want to work with complex numbers, you can work with complex numbers. But if you want to do physics, you kind of better choose some real form. So there are two versions of this magnetic chain, SU2 and SL2R. And we sort of have to keep track of this if you want to be careful. Okay, so this is a general case. Now let's specialize it for the reasons that will be clear very soon. Let's consider the case when all these Casimirs, S squared, I denoted them by delta squared, they're all the same. So in other words, all these vectors, they have the same length. But then these inhomogeneity parameters in the spin chain, they alternate. A minus A, A minus A, A minus A. Well, take this funny Hamiltonian, logarithm of the product of these transfer matrices. Again, I don't have time to explain why you take this, but that can be explained. If someone wants to hear more about it, I'll be here so you can ask me. Claim is the following. Let's take now delta to zero and n capital to the infinity in such a way that delta times n is fixed. In other words, we consider the continuum limit where delta we interpret as a spacing parameter. And assume that in this limit, our coordinate functions behave like this. Delta times some function of n times delta for the even sites, and for the odd sites, delta times some other function of the continuous coordinate. So then, as delta goes to zero, you will discover that these Poisson brackets, they will turn into these continuum Poisson brackets for s of x, t of y bracket will be zero, and then the same one for t's. Now, of course, you have to be careful how to understand these Poisson brackets. Now we have infinite dimensional Poisson manifold. You have to consider this as distributions and so on. One can carefully phrase what it really means. What's important is that the equations of motions will have this form. Time derivative of s is x derivative of s plus this cross term, the same for this. And if you will take the continuum limit of this Hamiltonian, you will discover that these equations are Hamiltonian with respect to these Poisson brackets with this Hamiltonian. Ps and Pt are sort of momenta for s and t. Poisson bracket of P with s of x is equal to x derivative of s, and Poisson bracket of t with t is x derivative of t, and Ps commutes with t, Pt commutes with s. So these are like in chiral Grosnevi model, that would be the momentum of the left chiral fields, momentum of the right chiral fields, and this would be left current times right current. Okay, so this is the limit of the equations of motions for this particular spin chain. Now, it's easy to notice that there are at least three different Hamiltonian systems with the same equations of motions. Another Hamiltonian system with the same equations of motions is this one. The brackets between S are the same. The brackets between T are the same as before. The only difference is that S and T, Poisson bracket, now is the delta prime. So this is like an anomaly. And if you really want to interpret S and T in terms of left and right currents, well, which is actually written here, you can read it. So let me continue. So the statement is that if you'll take these Poisson brackets, this Hamiltonian, I forgot the factor 1 over A here. There should be 1 over A. The equations of motions for S and T are the same. So this Hamiltonian system has the same equations of motions. And this Hamiltonian system can be derived from the Lagrangian, which is the Lagrangian of the principal chiral field theory. So this is just the Hamiltonian formulation of the principal chiral field theory. So, remarkable fact. We have equations of motions which are the same for two different Poisson structures. Let's remember it. But if you think about it a little more, you will discover that there is another infinitely many Hamiltonian systems with yet another Hamiltonian structure which have the same equations of motions. Yeah? Pardon? Yes. Yes, I was cheating. The phase space, it's a little bit different systems. So here S squared and T squared are 1. Here S squared and T squared, they are some variables, and they even don't commute with respect to the Poisson brackets. So there are some differences. And again, I just don't have time to discuss this. But yes, there is more differences that I mentioned. But the result remains the same. These Poisson brackets with this Hamiltonian produce the same equations of motions. If you will be analyzing this really carefully, you will discover that phase spaces are also slightly different. Now the same about this system. Let's take chiral gross nerve model. So S is the left chiral current, T is the right chiral current. You have fermions with two colors, with M flavors. M is any. Take the currents which are invariant with respect to flavors, and then, you know, usual canonical Poisson brackets for Psi plus Psi minus, and then you will discover that this Hamiltonian system has the same equations of motions. Of course, again, the phase space is different, but the fact remains that for these variables, which constitute sort of certain coordinates on certain submanifold of this Poisson system, the equations of motions are the same as here. So there's this puzzle. Why the equations of motions are the same for all these different Hamiltonian systems, and how these Hamiltonian systems are related to one to the other. So we were trying to answer this puzzle with Fadeev more than, again, this was 24 years ago. So for this, you have to quantize all of these systems. And again, I said that we were trying to answer this question. I think we answered it at some level, but then, of course, if you really want to have the complete answer, one should do much more work, and this is something that we didn't do. So let me try to explain in the remaining time some aspects of quantization of integrable systems and how to explain all these phenomena using quantization. So first, let's return to the very basic questions. Say, suppose that you have a Hamiltonian system. Most fundamental ingredient of any Hamiltonian system is a phase space. It's a manifold with a symplectic formula. So it's a symplectic manifold. The one that I consider it is R to N. So functions on this phase space is the classical algebra of observables. Now, physically, quantization is a big philosophical question with many ideas, and a Hamiltonian picture is just one of them. You can argue that, say, path integral picture is the other way to do it. Lagrangian quantization is the other way to do it. If your space-time is a cylinder, then it's equivalent to the Hamiltonian picture, but if it has more complicated topology, it's something different. So this point of view, Hamiltonian point of view, is sufficient in many ways, but I just don't want to claim that it's a universal panacea sort of that solves all questions. But it solves quite a lot of questions. So I'll focus on this particular point of view. So functions on the phase space. Quantization of these functions is an associative algebra, and mathematically it's quite well understood that you can think of this as of this associative algebra as the following. You have the pointwise multiplication of functions on the phase space. And what you can try to do is you can try to deform this commutative multiplication into a non-commutative one, such that the first term of this deformation is given by the Poisson bracket. So this is the so-called deformation quantization point of view. And there are many other points of view, but the outcome is the same. You have an associative algebra that is almost commutative as h goes to 0, and that in the classical limit reproduces the Poisson algebra of classical observables. Now, a Hamiltonian is a function, classical Hamiltonian, is an element in this algebra of functions. How does it quantize? It quantizes to an element of this associative algebra. So mathematically, if you just want to quantize a Hamiltonian system, it's a very poor structure. You just have an associative algebra and an element in this associative algebra. The best you can do is you can construct some representation space, some vector space where your quantum observables act, and you can try to diagonalize this Hamiltonian, so you can try to find the energy levels. And this is exactly the typical problem of quantization. So you construct some element of the algebra, you evaluate it in some representation space, for example, in functions of Q where P act by differential operators, and you want to find the spectrum of this operator. Now, if you have an integrable system, you have n of these functions, which I didn't finish, which Poisson commute. So the bracket is zero. And then mathematically, this is already very interesting. You know, mathematically, the more structure you have, the more rigid the whole situation is, the more interesting it is, because you have more chances to classify it. So basically, most of the modern mathematics is about the following. You have some objects, then you have some equivalences between these objects, and you want to classify these objects modulo these equivalences. So if you have these integrals, it's much better from the algebraical point of view. You have the algebra, and you have a maximal commutative subalgebra in this algebra. And, basically what you want to do is you want to find the spectrum of this, joint spectrum of these operators in some representation space. So, but now it's a non-trivial question. Say, suppose you have a given quantization of the phase space of your algebra of classical observables. You have classical integrals. How to construct elements, n independent elements, which would commute in the quantum case? Well, these are the main problems. So first, how to quantize at all, and then how to quantize an integrable system. First problem is how to construct this algebra. Second problem is how to construct a maximal commutative subalgebra of A. And the answer to the first problem was given, a rather complete answer was given recently by Kantsevich, who classified these possible deformations. The answer to how to quantize integrable systems, again, there are two possible answers, constructive and the existence theorem. So the existence theorem, it's a good question to how to do it in the general situation, but if you want to do something practical, we have to have some kind of scheme, just maybe similar to those that I described for classical systems. So this is the scheme. So the main idea is that once you have an integrable system, you know that kind of effectively this integrable system that can be effectively studied have to have Lux representation. Because of this, kind of a natural thing to do is not to quantize just integrals, but to quantize the whole thing, to quantize the Lux pair. And that was essentially the idea by Fadeev, which was implemented first in this joint paper by Fadeev and Skranin. And then it was developed to by many people to kind of almost a set of instructions how to do. So so let me very briefly describe this. So if you have a classical R matrix, what you have to do is you have to construct a quantum R matrix, which is the identity plus power series in the Planck constant, which starts with H times the classical R matrix. And this power series should satisfy the Young-Baxter equation. Then you have to replace the the algebra of Poisson brackets between L operator to the quantum algebra of quantum Lux operators. And then spectral functions of the classical L operator should be replaced by some kind of quantum analog of spectral functions of this quantum L operator. And then at the end of the day, you will find the right number of commuting elements. So again, this is a very short cut through a long subject. But then the next problem is how to find the spectrum of these quantum integrals. Question? Pardon?
Is it true that Poisson structure is always given by R matrix?
Is it true that the Poisson structure is always like this? No, it's not true. There are Hamiltonian systems. It's not true. I will answer in details later. I want to finish what I was planning to do. And I have only 7 minutes left, I think. So, okay, so now let's discuss the computation of the spectrum in this example, in the quantization. So remember this spin chain that I was describing, that's the classical R matrix. It's easy to see that the quantum R matrix has this form. If you divide by lambda, it will have the form 1 plus more or less this operator divided by lambda. And this lambda is different from this lambda by the rescaling by a Planck constant. So P here is the permutation operator. And it's easy to see that permutation operator is equal to 1 plus this tensor divided by 2. So this is why it's more or less what's written there. So the algebra of quantum L operators will be this one. It will involve this R matrix. It's, again, you should think of this algebra as an infinite dimensional algebra generated by L of lambda, which satisfies with these conditions, with these relations. There's this huge ideal in this algebra. If you will quotient it out, you will end up with a finite dimensional algebra generated by S. This algebra is simply the universal enveloping algebra of SL2. And this operator satisfies these relations. So then after this, you can take the product of these L operators, take its trace, and you will get the commuting operators in the tensor product of n copies of the universal enveloping algebra of SL2. And for obvious reasons, this is a quantization of the spin chain that I started with for this classical spin chain. Okay, so then the spectrum. Well, here we have to be careful. Remember I said about SU2 and SL2R. There's a conceptual difference in representation theory of these Lie algebras. These are groups, but they have corresponding Lie algebras. I'm talking about Lie algebras. So irreducible unitary representations of SU2 are finite dimensional. And kind of geometrically, these are the spheres. And the parameter of representation is sort of the radius of this sphere. The representations of S, unitary irreducible representations of SL2R, there are three types of these representations. There is principal unitary series that geometrically corresponds to this connected hyperboloids, connected level surface of the Minkowski Casimir. And you can visualize that they have no highest weight, no lowest weight vector, because you can go from top to bottom without any problem, from the high end to the low end. Then there are discrete series. That's these hyperboloids, d plus, d minus. These have highest, lowest weight vector. These have highest weight vector. And then there are exceptional series that nobody is interested in. So the spectrum for real forms and for Casimirs fixed in this way are different. For finite dimensional representations and the discrete series representations, the answer is given by so-called algebraic Betansatz. So for this, I have to explain what is ABC. And ABC is simply the following. You take this T that I wrote here, and you write this as 2x2 matrix with matrix elements acting in the space of states, in the representation space. And then the answer for the eigenvalues is given by this Baxter equation, where A and B can be computed, and Q is a polynomial, with zeros being these particular Vs. And omega is either highest weight vector or lowest weight vector, depending on which one exists in your representation. And this is, and then, so from the talks that I heard here, I understand that most of the people are here, everybody knows the rest of the story, so then you have better equations, you solve them, and so on. So then, for the principal unitary series, the answer is different. It's similar to the problem that would exist for two-day system, where there is no so-called pseudo-vacuum, there are no highest weight, lowest weight representations. Then Sklenin invented this technique of separation of variables. And I'm talking about these papers that are more than 20 years old, or maybe 20 years old. So basically what he said is that now there are many things that I should have said here, but I don't have time. But the bottom line is that now the function Q is not a polynomial, but it's in a certain class of functions that have many, infinitely many zeros. And Jörg Teschner, yesterday, he discussed this specific kind of, this model that he discussed is closely related to what I'm talking about. It's essentially a particular case of this model. So in this case, Q are functions, and the problem has somewhat different flavor, but then we have to remember that nobody really cares about finite dimensional integrable systems. The reason why so much attention is paid to integrable systems is because we want to understand quantum field theory, which is infinite dimensional, and so we really want to understand infinite dimensional systems. The problem is that they have many problems, ultraviolet, infrared, and so on, so one should regularize them somehow. So we should consider all these systems as a kind of super regularization of things that we want to see in the continuum limit. So what we must do is we should take the limit n goes to the infinity. And I think I'm running out of time. Do I still have a few minutes? I need just one more transparency. Okay. So we have to be careful when we take the limit n goes to the infinity. Here's a question to a mathematics or physics graduate student. If you take C2 to the n and will send n to the infinity, does it give you some reasonable Hilbert space? And everybody knows the answer, no. It's not going to be separable Hilbert space. It's going to be something horrible. So the best you can expect is that there exists some reasonable limit as n goes to the infinity, which is the kind of continuum direct integral of some Hilbert spaces. This goes back to essentially, this idea goes back to von Neumann. Now here, one can show that as n goes to the infinity, this space is the direct path integral. Essentially, it's a direct integral over some infinite dimensional variety of vacua. And for each vacua, you have vacuum, you have a Hilbert space. This vacua, roughly speaking, they are parameterized by expectation values of the density of commuting integrals in this vacuum. So it's something like, you can say, magnetizations for the integrals or something like this. So after you take the limit n goes to the infinity along this vacua, the theories will be completely different for each of this vacuum. The simplest example that everybody knows, there is anti-ferromagnetic and ferromagnetic ground state. But the point is that there is the whole infinite dimensional variety of those, depending on how you feel the Dirac C. So here is the picture which is supposed to answer to this puzzle about the classical Hamiltonian systems. They have the same equations of motions. Okay, so let me just explain this point of view in this picture. So let's start with this alternating quantum spin chain. The spectral parameters in the spin chain, they alternate lambda plus A, lambda minus A, lambda plus A, lambda minus A. N is the length of it, S is the spin at every factor. So then we can play with all these parameters. One thing we can do is we can take the classical limit and obtain classical alternating discrete spin chain with n sites, with the length of the spin delta, with the parameter A classical. And that's the following limit. We should send the spin to the infinity. That's the classical limit when you have infinitely many degrees. Well, when spin goes to the infinity. So the length of the spin is 1 over h. The inhomogeneity, quantum inhomogeneity, should be renormalized accordingly. H goes to 0, n is fixed. You get this old friend that I described half an hour ago. Then from there, as I explained, you can take the limit delta goes to 0, n goes to the infinity, such a way that delta n is fixed, A is fixed. You get the kind of continuum alternated Landau-Lifshitz model, the equations for S and T that I wrote before. So this is one line of thoughts. Then, and it doesn't really matter which vacuum you take here because you keep n fixed in the semi-classical limit. But then what you can do is you can pass to the infinite dimensional system while you're still in the quantum case. Let's consider the thermodynamical limit, n goes to the infinity, infinitely long spin chain, over anti-ferromagnetic vacuum. This will be some quantum anti-ferromagnetic spin chain with parameters S and A. But something well-defined that can be studied by existing methods, for example, form factors can be computed using the these ideas of Smirnov, Jimba, Miva, correlation functions can be computed. It's just the usual spin chain with slightly unusual structure. And then if you look at the spectrum of this model, you can see that as A goes to the infinity, well, the spectrum will look like this. The energy versus the rapidity will have this form. So as A goes to the infinity, this gap will go to zero as e to the minus A. But then there will be these massless branches, and what you can do is you can just focus on the part of the spectrum that is massive and throw away these massless branches. And then in this scaling limit, what you will get is you will get a current flavorless sector of SU2 cross SU2S chiral Gross-Navier model, the quantum version of that classical system that I wrote there. And then with this model, you can do two things. First, you can pass to the classical limit, and you will get the these classical equations of motions that I wrote with the classical Hamiltonian. Or you can send spin to the infinity. And then you will get quantum principle chiral field theory. That's essentially similar to along the lines of this paper with this Polyakov and Wigman. So then as S goes to the infinity, you get principle chiral field theory. And then in this, and you can trace this on the S matrices. For example, the S matrix here, and the S matrix here will be more or less the product of SU2 S matrix times so-called RSOS S matrix. And as spin goes to the infinity, this RSOS part will degenerate into SU2 and you will get SU2 cross SU2. And then as you pass to H equals 0, you will recover the classical principle chiral field theory. So this is sort of the outline of our paper with Fadeev from 80-something. I don't remember the year. But it was more than 20 years ago. So this is sort of the idea that this quantization of integrable systems, once you go to infinite dimensional systems, it's a big and very interesting zoo. And somehow there are many limits like this. Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks for this beautiful lecture. I didn't dare to interrupt it, so we went a little bit over time. I think there's time for one or two short questions, but remember that this will be taken away from the coffee break. Because we'll start it in sharper.
It's a good question. The question is the following. How do we know that we have to choose this anti-ferromagnetic vacuum to deal with the problem? You see, the only way, the only reasonable kind of easy way to choose a vacuum is the following. You choose a Hamiltonian. And then your vacuum is just simply the lowest energy state of this Hamiltonian. If your Hamiltonian is some kind of weird combinations of integrals of motions, the vacuum will correspond to some specific values of expectation values of the integrals that would correspond to this particular minimum. Changing these weird combinations, you will go over this infinite dimensional variety of vacua. But because we know the Hamiltonian, so we kind of have to stick to the minimal value of the Hamiltonian in question. You remember I wrote this bunch of logarithms.
So the statement is that the variety is because you can choose any combination.
The statement is that this variety of vacuum appears because you can choose any combination of integrals of motion
yes.
to be a Hamiltonian.
Yes.
But if you fix a Hamiltonian, then the vacuum is unique.
Absolutely.
And there is no degree of arbitrariness.
Pardon?
Well, you discretize the system. What I'm trying to say is that a priori we are given some continuum system, not a discrete one.
Yes.
So basically what we first need to do is to discretize this continuum system.
Absolutely.
And it is known that there are many different ways to discretize the system.
Yeah. Well, we just hope for the best, that any reasonable discretization in the continuum limit, it there will be different discretizations, but
yeah.
then in the continuum limit it will reproduce you. You hope for some kind of universality.
Is there,
that in the continuum limit you get the...
Is there any counterexample?
Any?
Counterexample?
I don't know. Well, at least I don't remember any counterexamples that would...
So basically you suggest us to discretize string theory on ADS5S5 first, then apply all these methods, and then to take the continuum limit.
It depends on how much information you want. But if you really want to solve the problem, that's probably inevitable. By solving the problem, I mean if you want to compute everything, including correlation functions. Probably inevitable, maybe not.
I think we should stop now. Otherwise, there will be no coffee. So let's thank for your